Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege once again to present to you Peter Vogel, a researcher who has cast some incredible light on an event which took place in 1944 and is now coming back into widespread public view in 1999. Peter Vogel, welcome back once again to our airways.
Thanks, Dave. Always like to hear your voice.
Peter, if you would briefly tell us about the Port Chicago Mutiny. We're going to get to an analysis of the explosion itself and your analysis of same, but the Port Chicago Mutiny has been garnering headlines once again in 1999. If you could give us a synoptic account of that, please.
The Port Chicago Mutiny followed and was, in fact, precipitated by the July 17, 1944 explosion of the Port Chicago Naval Magazine on San Francisco Bay, or just above San Francisco Bay on the Sacramento River. And the men who survived the explosion, subsequently many of them, approximately 350 all told, refused duty in the weeks following the explosion. Several hundred of them, 275 to be precise, were convicted of charges lesser than mutiny in summary courts-martials, and 50 men were subsequently convicted in formal court-martial of mutiny in wartime.
And there is now a move to overturn the convictions of those who were convicted.
Yes.
Now, Peter, when you began investigating the Port Chicago explosion, well, actually your investigation came quite by accident, you were at a church rummage sale in New Mexico. Take the story from there, if you would.
It was here in Santa Fe, where I am recording this show with you, at the Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church out on the southern side of Santa Fe, on a rummage sale on a Sunday afternoon. And I was going through some of the materials that were there offered for sale and a box of photographic supplies that interested me particularly. And in the bottom of that box, there was a number 10 letter envelope that had no marking on it, but clearly had a piece of paper folded up inside it, which I removed and unfolded. It's about 17 inches long and 8.5 inches high, and that document is entitled The History of Port Chicago. What is that called? The History of 10,000-Ton Gadget.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line of that document, step 11, says, ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion.
Right. Now, this, of course, is a reference to the mushroom cloud explosion. And if you would tell us briefly, well, obviously we're going to be pressed for time here. What is it that makes a mushroom cloud mushroom out?
Well, it's basically... The ball of fire is what we're talking about, and that rises from any explosion, a chemical explosion or a nuclear explosion. It's very hot, much, much hotter in a nuclear explosion, of course. And as it rises, it cools, and it interacts with the cool air above it, which tends to flatten it out, and the shape of the smoke cloud actually becomes the mushroom cloud. The fireball at Port Chicago rose to... about 8,000 to 10,000 feet before it disintegrated into convection currents. And then above that, the smoke cloud rose to about 18,000 feet and did form a mushroom at that point.
Now, bear in mind that the official explanation for the Port Chicago explosion was the explosion of conventional explosives on an ammunition ship. Anyway, that's what the public was told. Bear that in mind as you listen to the following odyssey that Peter has gone through in order to bring the truth to light about Port Chicago. That odyssey, in one sense, began after your initial discovery, Peter, when you showed the history of the 10,000-ton gadget to Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb. He had a very interesting reaction.
Yes, and as it turns out, Dave, Edward Teller was also the father, so to speak, of the nuclear weapon that was detonated at Port Chicago. I had been acquainted with Dr. Teller at the University of California at Berkeley in the mid-60s when I was a student there, an undergraduate student, and I had gotten my introduction to physics from him in a class that that I had taken. And when I had circulated the document history of 10,000-ton gadget among scientists in New Mexico at the universities, everyone agreed that if anyone knew what the significance of the bottom line, a ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion, if anyone knew what that meant, it would be Edward Teller. So I called him up and made an appointment to be able to meet with him. Didn't really tell him what I wanted to talk about, honestly, and went over with a Nikon camera and a motor base and a big strobe and put this document into his hands and started taking pictures of him reading it. And I said, look at the bottom line and tell me what it means, where it says ball of fire mushroom out at 18,000 feet in typical Port Chicago fashion. And he said, well, that refers to the Port Arthur explosion. And I said, no, no, Ed, it says Port Chicago, not Port Arthur. Port Arthur, Texas, had blown up in 1962, I believe, destroyed the port. And then I said, what does it mean? And he said, I believe you have a classified document that I will decline to ever acknowledge that I've seen this document or that I ever discussed Port Chicago with you. I then, at his suggestion, took the document to the classification office at Los Alamos National Laboratory, where Dr. Teller and I were meeting. And I walked over there and I asked them, gave them a copy, and I said, what does the bottom line mean? And about a month later, they got back to me and said if I wanted to know about Port Chicago, I should look it up in the Encyclopedia Americana under disasters.
Note again the alarm on the part of Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, about what is supposedly an explosion of a World War II ammunition ship. It turns out, Peter, that the Los Alamos Laboratory had been extremely interested in the Port Chicago explosion right about the time it occurred. Tell us about that, if you would.
It was indeed. The most important person at Los Alamos who was concerned with the Port Chicago explosion was United States Naval Captain William S. Parsons, who was at that time the director of the Ordnance Division at the Los Alamos Laboratories and Manhattan Project, and he was responsible for the ordnance development of the atomic bombs. So as soon as the explosion of Port Chicago had occurred, Captain Parsons and two scientists from the Los Alamos Laboratory, Naval Ensign George Reynolds and Dr. Maurice Shapiro, flew out to San Francisco, and apparently 2 days after the explosion arrived at the Port Chicago base and began several weeks of very intensive analyses of the effects of the explosion.
And again, note that William Parsons is an individual whose name crops up in connection with the subsequent history of the development of nuclear weapons. Review that for us, if you would, Peter.
Captain Parsons, after the war, had acquired a great deal of experience with nuclear weapons, and he was then appointed technical director for the 1946 atomic tests that were conducted at the Bikini Atoll in the Pacific Ocean.
And he also, remember, had been the bombing officer aboard the Enola Gay, which dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Peter, tell us about the Mark I and Hiroshima bomb, if you could briefly explain the principle behind that. And this is the Mark I went on Hiroshima, Mark III went on Nagasaki, and we're going to talk about the Mark II later in the program. Tell us briefly about the principle behind Mark I.
Mark I was originally an atomic bomb concept that was developed by the British, actually two emigre scientists who had escaped Nazi Germany and had gone to England. And they conceived the original development of the Mark I weapon, which was an ordnance, a gun-based atomic bomb design. Captain Parsons was the Navy's leading ordnance officer, and this program, this design, was given to Captain Parsons for his consideration and asked whether, as an ordnance officer, it could be made to work. And the way that it worked in its final operation at Hiroshima on the 6th of August, 1945, was this. An unrifled, modified, lightweight, 5-inch naval anti-aircraft gun barrel was modified to make an atomic bomb. And at the breech end of the gun, a subcritical mass of highly enriched uranium was fired down this unrifled naval gun tube by a black powder charge. At the opposite end of the gun barrel, screwed onto it in a very heavy, massive steel box, was a second mass of fissionable uranium. When the uranium projectile had been fired down the gun barrel into the target, the two subcritical masses of uranium merged, forming a supercritical mass of uranium, and the weapon exploded.
Now, according to the official history of the development of the Mark I, the weapon dropped on Hiroshima, it was never tested prior to the attack on Hiroshima, because there wasn't enough fissionable uranium that was available at that prior to that time. Upon your investigation, you found out that was not true. Tell us about that.
Yes, Dave. In 1980, in order to make a satisfactory argument that it was even possible for an atomic bomb to have been detonated at Port Chicago in July of 1944, I had to be able to demonstrate that fissionable material was available to permit that test. Now, when I began looking into the uranium production data prior to the Port Chicago explosion, I found that the production data actually was classified and was not publicly available. The anecdotal history of the Manhattan Project maintained that only enough fissionable uranium for the Hiroshima bomb had been produced by the summer of 1945, and that therefore a test of the Mark I Hiroshima weapon could not have been conducted with active material. It was very thoroughly tested in terms of its operation mechanically with depleted uranium, non-fissionable depleted uranium as a stand-in for the real active material that would be used on the 6th of August, 1945 at Hiroshima.
Okay, and bear in mind, too, that there are a number of things, as the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott has pointed out. Very often a political conspiracy cannot be discerned by examining the conspiracy itself, but very often one can examine the cover-up, and that in turn will delineate the lines of the conspiracy itself. Now, with regard to the Port Chicago explosion, it is the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship called the E.A. Bryan, and you point out in your original article, The Last Wave from Port Chicago, from the spring 1982 edition of the Black Scholar, that shortly before Port Chicago, the E.A. Bryan had been fitted with special booms to handle a heavier weight load. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, I will, Dave. The E.A. Bryan was indeed the ship that exploded. But I go back just for a moment to your question about the availability of uranium material for the Mark I device that was detonated at Nagasaki.
No, the Mark I at Hiroshima, right?
Oh, pardon me, yes.
I do that myself. Mark I Hiroshima, Mark III, that was the plutonium weapon at Nagasaki. We're going to touch on that later. Go ahead, Peter.
When I found, Dave, that the uranium production data for the years 1943 through 1949 were not available, and therefore that the anecdotal history of the Manhattan Project that said that no material had been produced in excess of what was required for the one weapon used at Hiroshima, I began a search for that data. I was at that time employed by the state of New Mexico in the Energy and Minerals Department in the Resource and Development Division, and had access to a wide range of individuals in the Department of Energy. And after a number of months, I was able to identify two offices of the Department of Energy, one in Washington, D.C., and one at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where I was told the production data for the years 1943 through 1949 would be available, and I was told the names of the men in those offices who would have access to that data. And on the 5th of December, 1980, I called those two men on the telephone, and I said, I represent the state of New Mexico, and I need that data, if you please. And the data was provided to me by telephone and later confirmed in correspondence. And those data showed that by the time of the Port Chicago explosion, there was sufficient material for 11 minimum critical mass atomic bombs of the type that was used at Hiroshima.
Indicating, obviously, some dissembling on the part of officials.
Well, yes, and that comes back to Peter Dale Scott, where there is evidence of a cover-up. There is evidence that there's something fishy going on. But going back to the Bryan and your question about that, the E.A. Bryan was indeed the ship that was docked at the Port Chicago facility, which exploded. And immediately prior to the ship's arrival at the Port Chicago pier, it had been taken to the Richmond, California shipyards on San Francisco Bay, and the cargo booms and the cables that operate the cargo booms to lift cargo from the dock into the cargo holds of the ship had been replaced, and the standard booms and rigging on the E.A. Bryan, which were capable of a maximum load of 5,000 pounds were replaced to accommodate a load of 10,000 pounds, which is slightly more than the weight of the weapon that was subsequently detonated in Hiroshima.
The characteristics of the explosion, Peter, are not consistent. In your original article, you pointed out that the characteristics of the explosion of the E.A. Bryan are not consistent with the physical characteristics of the explosion of conventional, the detonation of the conventional explosives. First of all, the eyewitnesses reported a white flash. If you would go over that and explain its significance to us.
Yes. A chemical explosion, such as TNT or dynamite, produces a maximum temperature of about 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And a nuclear weapon, when it explodes, produces a temperature in millions of degrees. The consequence of such a high temperature, as is generated by an atomic bomb, is that the atmosphere immediately surrounding the fireball from the explosion is lit up. It becomes incandescent because of the extremely high temperature, and it flashes with an intense flash of white light. And that flash of light from the Port Chicago explosion, which was reported even by Time magazine in the month following the explosion, that brilliant flash of white light illuminated the countryside as far, according to reports, as far as 75 miles distant from Port Chicago. The nighttime was lit up as if in the bright noonday sun. Now, that's characteristic of an atomic bomb, and it's not characteristic of a chemical explosion, even of the magnitude of an ammunition ship blowing up all at once.
So again, the high temperatures which cause the white flash are characteristic of a nuclear explosion, and the much lower temperatures in the yellow or orange ball of fire from the explosion of TNT or Torpex is what would be expected from the explosion of an ammunition ship.
Yes, that's correct, Dave.
Okay. Another thing that explosives experts had pointed out, and that you point out in your article, is that normally in the explosion of an ammunition ship, and several have gone off before, only a small percentage of the explosives goes off high order. So if you would develop that further for us.
Well, in an explosion, say it occurred in the number three hold of an ammunition ship, that explosion would tend to disintegrate the ship and blow a lot of the munitions in the forward and aft cargo holds up into the air without detonating those. Those that were close to the original explosion would probably not detonate entirely, but would actually just burn off without a substantial, what's called high-order detonation. And there were, in fact, tons of munitions that had not exploded that were scattered all around the Port Chicago facility.
And you also point out in your article that the damage not only to the physical facilities around Port Chicago, but to Suisun Bay, another ammunition ship, the Connaught Victory, was sunk on the other side of the bay, that this is not what would be expected from, that there was too much damage to be accounted for by the conventional explosion, we were told it was.
That's true. The damage from the Port Chicago explosion really exceeded the capacity of the munitions that were on the ship, even if they had exploded entirely high order. So there was definitely some source of explosive energy that could not be accounted for by the munitions that were loaded aboard the E.A. Bryan.
Now, in your Last Wave from Port Chicago article, which again came out in the Black Scholars issue of spring of 1982, you concluded that, in fact, the Port Chicago explosion was the explosion of the Mark I, an actual test or explosion of the Mark I weapon, the type of device that was used on Hiroshima. And then right after the publication of your article, something very interesting happened to the status of the Army and Navy Explosive Safety Board Technical Paper Number 6 report on Port Chicago.
Yes. The Technical Paper Number 6 of the Army-Navy Explosive Safety Board does deal in exquisite detail with the Port Chicago explosion. And immediately following publication of my original article, The Last Wave from Port Chicago in the Black Scholar in spring 1982, the Navy immediately reclassified that technical paper that dealt with the Port Chicago explosion, reclassified it in such a way that it would be available thereafter, and even unto today, available only to Department of Defense contractors who had legitimate business to study that particular explosion.
And again, I would note that this is in 1982. It would be difficult to imagine something more mundane than the explosion of a World War II ammunition ship. Why reclassify that top secret after the publication of your article. Peter, you also dealt with a film which was represented as a simulation of Port Chicago, but upon examination, that thesis didn't hold up real well. Tell us about the film.
I had assumed that someone, probably the Navy, would have made a motion picture film of the explosion, and I had looked for that film in all the military services archives and everywhere I could look, you know, every possibility, and I didn't find it anywhere. And then I visited the Port Chicago Public Affairs Office in 1981 and was meeting there with the public affairs officer, and I said, well, you know, I just keep looking for a film of this explosion. I haven't been able to find one. And Mr. Tikowski, the public affairs officer, said, well, we have it, and we have it in the safe. And I said, well, I'm astonished. I'd like to see it. And he said, what's your interest in it? And I said, well, I think it's a film of a nuclear bomb detonation that was conducted here at Port Chicago. And he said, well, wait just a minute. And he left the office for 4 or 5 minutes and came back and said, well, you're not going to be able to see it. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, because it's a nitrate-based film, and if we take it out of the safe, it's going to be so old that it's just going to disintegrate, and we don't want that to happen. Well, I said, how was the film made? And he said it was made at the time that the town of Port Chicago was purchased by the Navy, and it was a film made to demonstrate what would happen in the event of another large explosion if the town of Port Chicago were not removed from the map. And I said, well, when was that film made? And he said it was made in 1967. Well, I went away, Dave, knowing quite well to myself that nitrate-based film had been taken out of service in 1950 because it's a highly explosive material and was, in fact, the cause of many motion picture theater fires.
Sure.
When the film would ignite.
So, once again, there's obviously official dissembling, although this is portrayed as being a simulation. The evidence would suggest that it was an actual film of the actual explosion.
Well, I actually was able to obtain critical portions of that film from KQED television station in San Francisco, to whom it had been made available for different reasons than mine. And they had critical portions of that film that they made available to me. And in my opinion then, and it's now confirmed, that the sequence of that film in every respect is the record of a nuclear detonation, although the Navy had said that it was a studio-manufactured film that had been done in miniature.
Again, note the dissembling on the type of film. Why misrepresent something unless there's something to hide? Peter, when a television documentary was done about Port Chicago, and you deal in your article with the high cancer rates in Contra Costa County, but it turned out that the cancer rates for Contra Costa County for the 2 to 3 years immediately after Port Chicago were missing. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, that's information that the film producers had developed themselves, and I'm not entirely familiar with that, but it's certainly credible evidence. I had reviewed the information in their sources when that was broadcast, and apparently there were a high incidence of cancers in the area of Port Chicago and what would have been downwind.
Mm-hmm.
But those data from the immediate years following the war were, in fact, missing when the television station that made that film looked for them.
You also found that a record of a rail car, was it two rail cars, that had gone from Los Alamos to Port Chicago, that the record of the contents of that had been destroyed.
There are, at Los Alamos National Laboratory, 7 linear feet of documentary materials on the Port Chicago explosion that Captain Parsons and Ensign Reynolds and Dr. Shapiro had, and other investigators from Port Chicago, from Los Alamos, had put together. In 1981, I had access to all of those materials in the archive at Los Alamos, and I found one documentary page that listed 2 railroad cars, and each of those railroad cars had an asterisk after it, and at the bottom of the page, the reference for that asterisk said, records showing that the contents of these cars were loaded aboard the Bryan, we destroyed. And therefore, the contents of those cars do not appear on the list of materials that had been loaded aboard the Bryan prior to the explosion. So, you know, clearly Los Alamos had destroyed records that the contents of these two railroad cars had been loaded aboard the Bryan prior to the explosion. It's my contention that the bomb that was used at Port Chicago had been divided into two critical components and transported to the Port Chicago base in those two cars.
And the whatever was in those two cars, the records of that were destroyed shortly afterward. We're going to be continuing with our discussion of Port Chicago, what actually happened, what didn't happen, what people are saying happened, and reflecting on not only the past, but on the future. However, we're going to do that in our next half hour. For Peter Vogel, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.